Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I'm your host, John Lossov. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
So as you guys can see, I'm wearing a sleeveless shirt, and boy, did it come in handy today. So I'm walking down the street, and this translucent deity comes up to me, and he kind of starts talking smack, and we kind of get into a knife fight, and I throw a knife, I miss, right? He picks up the knife, he throws it at me, I catch it, and I throw it back at him, and I hit him right in the head.
Oh, wow.
So I saved the world today, guys, just because of my sleeveless shirt.
Pretty good reflexes you got there.
Yeah. I mean, this is like, if I had sleeves, our world would not be here today.
Right.
You would have had the proper shoulder rotational speed, the torque.
Yeah, the torque would not have existed.
I feel like that should be a question on a physics exam. Like, what is the speed that Kurt Russell can throw a knife with us? With a sleeveless shirt and with a sleeved shirt.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. I mean, all I know is I saved the world today.
Nice. So that actually reminds me of, like, taking, like, I don't know if it was, like, calculus 2 or 3, where you start calculating limits, like, theoretical limits with calculus. And so I wonder, like, sometimes the answer is does not exist. The limit does not exist. Is that like if you calculate the limit of Kurt Russell's shoulder torque, is the answer that it does not exist?
Does not exist.
Like it's some physics theory.
It broke the machinery. Like, you know, they do that sports science on ESPN. Like, he literally breaks everything.
Listen, Stephen Hawking's working on it. He's been working on it for the past decade. He hasn't made much progress, but he's on the case. John Lemongood, say hi to everyone.
How's it going, folks? So I just saw the trailer for Krampus, and both I and Reddit are very excited to see this movie.
I mean, it's Trick or Treat has the most vocal audience ever. The director of Trick or Treat's finally directing another movie, and it looks like a mixture of Trick or Treat and Rare Exports, which is glorious. So I am count me in.
Well, and it has a great, like, smart cast. It's got, like, I can't say his name, David Koechner.
Yeah,
Koechner.
Like, he's from Cheap Thrills and Final Destination 5, so he's done horror dark comedy, and it's got Adam Scott, and he was in The Overnight, which I haven't seen, and Piranha 3D, and Hellraiser 4. Like, so they've both done horror, and it's got Conchata Ferrell, who's the maid from 2.5 Men, so we know she's good at dark comedy anyway. And it's got someone else, Toni Collette, who's just done serious stuff. But so this has a real cast. Like, these people were impressed by the script, I'd like to think.
And you know what? I'm so happy that David Koechner's in it, because he was amazing in Cheap Thrills. And I loved his lines in this about the dried chicken. And then, like, he was talking about the food. And they're like, well, we have leftovers to eat. Or, like, all the power goes out. And she's like, well, we have leftovers to eat. And Koechner goes, beer it is.
He's complaining at the dinner table, but and Adam Scott's saying, "Oh yeah, honey, the turkey came out great." And Koechner says, "Mine's dry." And he says, "Well, mine's really great. Mine's dry." And Adam Scott just says, "I'm like, do you want to trade?"
You know, when he dies, it's going to be amazing.
Oh no!
You know what I mean? Like not in real life, but when he eats his cinematic peril, you're going to be so happy.
I can't believe none of you have mentioned that he was an Anchorman. Come on.
Well, we're just mentioning horror movies right now.
I'm just saying. You gotta mention
good old Champ? Is that Champ? Whammy.
Yeah.
Whammy!
He's good at knife fighting, I guess.
Yeah. All right. It's time to start the podcast like we do every podcast with listener questions. Mark, you got the questions this week, right?
Yep. So the first question is from Jeff DeCook, longtime listener, first-time question asker. and this is from Facebook. He asks, what are your three favorite Jamie Kennedy films? Now, a lot of people are laughing. They think of Jamie Kennedy, you know, Son of the Mask, as kind of like a buffoon. But he's been in some great films. And so I'm going to say my favorite Jamie Kennedy film is Bowfinger. I love Bowfinger. I think it is great. Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy, he plays the camera guy in it. And he's, like, really dry and funny, and he works with Steve Martin perfectly. And he's also in, like, Romeo and Juliet and Three Kings. So you can't go wrong with those.
I don't know. When I first read that question, I'm just like, I the only thing I can even think of three Jamie Kennedy movies that I liked a lot. The first one that comes to mind is Malibu's Most Wanted.
Yes!
Because, like,
oh, yes!
Listen, I know it's a bad movie, but I like the fact that, like, they just went for it. Like, it's like they knew it was a bad movie, but let's just do it and see what happens. It was just like, and that was the result. So,
and it has one of my favorite lines. He's like talking to this guy, and this guy's like, you know, I got a Gamecast. He's like, well, actually, there's a GameCube and a Dreamcast. And he's like, I don't know, man, I don't have no money.
I know.
And he's acting with, like, Regina Hall, who's this very good actress. Yeah. And, like, he's just, like, in these – I don't know how they – why did they make that? Like, you know, I love Hollywood because things like that come out of Hollywood occasionally. And, like, Tate Diggs and Anthony Anderson, who are big actors, are, like, playing Juilliard-trained Shakespearean actors who are playing, like, these kind of thug-type guys.
Weren't they, like, paid by his dad to scare him into not being, like, a little, like, I don't know –
yeah.
One gangster rapper white boy.
Yeah. And, like, this sounds bad, but whenever I think about the movie, it puts a smile on my face because I have two good stories about this. And, you know, we go up to visit a family in Iowa. My brother was up there and we did, like, a family movie night with, like, a bunch of young kids. And, you know, I was older at the time. But there was a bunch of young 11-year-old, 9-year-olds watching it. And my brother picked out Malibu's Most Wanted.
Oh.
So about 20 of us sat around watching Malibu's Most Wanted on a night. And then also during college and undergrad at Florida State, I went to three different Blockbuster videos and to buy it on previously viewed DVD. And I bought Malibu's Most Wanted on previously viewed DVD. So I have a history with that film.
Yeah, that's my only pick, really.
What about you, Levengood?
All right, well, first off, other than Malibu's Most Wanted and Son of the Mask, most of the movies you guys mentioned, I didn't even remember that Jamie Kennedy was in them.
Three Kings, dude, that's a great movie.
Yeah, it is a great movie. I remember the Three Kings characters. I don't remember him.
He was Jamie Kennedy in it.
Yeah, I don't remember. But yeah, like, I don't even remember. For me, it's Scream 1, Scream 2, and Scream 3 in that order.
Dude, he was so good in Scream.
I know. Well, in those movies, he is. So you know how, like, you watch a horror movie, and every now and then you have to remind yourself that in a horror movie, you have to assume that other horror movies don't exist? Because otherwise they wouldn't make all these mistakes, and they, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so, but in that movie, in Scream, he knows what's up. So if a real horror movie started happening around us, and we knew everything that we know, he is us. He is the horror movie meta geek.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he thinks the way that we think, but he thought it before we thought it.
Yep.
He was Cabin in the Woodsing before Joss Whedon pulled the Cabin in the Woods.
So you're saying we are all Malibu's Most Wanted.
I'm just saying Scream 1 to 3.
Like, but Bowfinger, guys. John, you wrote a post about the fight in Bowfinger.
And I love that movie, and I really don't remember him in it.
He's so, like, happy and dry, and he works he has a big role in it. Like, I don't know. He was in Boiler Room. Like, the dude started off with a pretty good career, and then he didn't. But
well, he did Malibu's Most Wanted, so it's a weird toss-up. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, That's right. All right, so our next question is, let's see. Have you watched, you know, when Key and Peele, they talk about Liam Neeson? They're like the valets, and they're talking about Liam Neeson and just freaking out, like, Liam Neeson's Taken! And they're freaking out about that movie Taken, and they're just like, They're absolutely going crazy about Liam Neeson's in that film Taken. So what are some movies that, like, if you were a valet and you had a buddy there with you, that you would absolutely pull a Liam Neeson's Key and Peele with?
Okay, so I think, like, the feeling of this question, like, they're looking for, like, kind of like a movie that you wouldn't expect. Because, like, you know, if I said, like, Star Wars or Indiana Jones, like, people would expect that. Like, oh, everybody was crazy for that. So I'm guessing, yeah, like, the asker, like, he wants to, like, hear, like, what movie that we wouldn't expect to say or hear. So, I don't know. This is, I think I mentioned this before about my love for this movie, but Idle Hands. Like,
oh, just, yeah.
I don't know why, but I love that movie. I think, like, one summer, I think, like, in high school, I literally watched it every day. It was kind of sad and pathetic, but something about that movie just resonated with me. I don't know. Like, it was a bad movie. I know that. But I liked it. I don't know.
It's good enough that Idle Hands has come up in more than one podcast now.
Yeah. So what are some, like, moments, John? You're on the street and you're talking about Idle Hands. Like, how would you freak out?
It's like, dude, do you remember when Devin Sawa tried to smoke that oregano? he just coughed. Or, like, let's see, when he kills Seth Green by smashing the glass bottle on his head. Or also, if you want to get graphic, the boob scene.
Okay, I think I held back. I don't recall specifically, but the last time that came up in a podcast, I didn't want to bring up the boob scene. I didn't want to be that dude. But now that you did it, that was one of the best gratuitous nudity boobs I've ever seen in a movie.
Right. So for like a PG explanation of that scene.
It was in a parking lot at a Kiss concert.
Okay. So I'm going to give like a PG explanation of that scene. You have two lovers in a car expressing their feelings for each other. It gets kind of hot. So they just kind of, you know, adjust to the situation. And then like the evil hand comes in, worms his way like into the moment. And just, he just kind of kills them both in a very, very funny and very gratuitous manner.
And it was the kind of PG love scene that you expect to happen in the parking lot during a Kiss concert.
It was a Kiss concert.
Like, dude, and like Offspring were in that movie. Like, if you're a product of the 90s, you love that movie because it's like...
Can I just mention how weird it was that the Offspring was in that movie? Like, they were like the Offspring band, but they were playing like at a high school. And it wasn't even like prom or homecoming. It was just like a Halloween dance.
Yeah.
So it didn't even get like the big ones. They just got some random Halloween dance.
So who do they get for prom? Like, was Aerosmith showing up?
Probably.
But like, right, so you have Devin Sawa, you have like a young Jessica Alba, and then you have Offspring. If you're a product for the 90s, you're like, or you like, oh,
also,
my God. Like,
also Vivica A. Fox. She played like a demon.
Oh, yeah.
and Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah,
Seth MacFarlane. What's it?
Is Seth Green.
Seth, yeah, Green. Seth Green.
And Eldon Henson, who's in Daredevil now, right? Henson. So I was going to say Big Trouble in Little China, but we talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
So I actually put up a list of 10, but I'm just going to bring up one. Too Fast, Too Furious.
Ugh.
I will be jumping all over the street talking about, like, when Paul Walker stares down Eva Mendes, or, like, that climatic scene when Tyrese steals the cigar cutter and Cole Hauser catches him. Or the scene where, like, Tyrese is always hungry. I'm like, Tyrese is hungry? Tyrese is always hungry! Or, you know, at the end when, like, when they both stuff their pants with money. I mean, dude, I would be running up and down the... I wouldn't work. I would be running up and down the block screaming about Too Fast.
Like, it's like, I just wanted to park my car, but he couldn't stop talking about Too Fast, Too Furious.
Pockets ain't empty, cuz. I'd be asking for tips, like, just kind of like, you know, put in my pocket.
Yeah.
But I also had Life Aquatic on there, Bowfinger, Edge of Tomorrow, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, Point Break, The Guard, The Descent, and Dr. Strangelove. Those are my Key and Peele movies.
Point Break.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What do you got, Levin Good?
So, like, the first things that came to mind were just more obvious, like, 80s, 90s Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, like Red Heat and Total Recall and things like that. Like, yeah, I love those. And then, like, more modernly, Tony Jaa and Scott Adkins movies, because they do their own stunts, and they're, like, the best I've ever seen, except for maybe Jackie Chan and the history of doing your own stunts in movies. But, you know, the movies that, while I watch them, I make the most noise... Bring it on, you got served, step up.
What kind of noise are you making?
No, okay, so you get the classic, oh, like whenever Arnold hits somebody, or that, like, kind of you're smiling while nodding a little too hard, like, yeah, when Arnold does his one-liner or something, or when Scott Adkins does his stunts, you know, you kind of lean back in your seat and your feet come off the floor, like, oh, like you're just too shocked while you cover your mouth. But then like Bring It On and Step Up and You Got Served. When I saw those movies, I was as loud as anything in those theaters. Like, I love those movies with fun stunts that make you fantasize that you had your own like hip hop crew.
You know what I was thinking about? If think Pitch Perfect, when that kid at the end sings, "I got the magic in me," I wanted to get up and down the theater and just scream and go, "Oh yeah!"
and then the Indian dude jumps in front with the cap and he busts in with the rap. Yeah. And when he was rapping, like wooing the girls, like pointing to them, like you with the eyes, that line, okay. Like I felt like he was talking to me. I felt touched. I was so taken by that rap.
I would not drive any cars if I was valeting talking about that movie. I'd be up guys, down the street.
If you guys are working valet as valets and Anna Kendrick pulls up in her car, you would just be like,
okay, wait, hold on. If Mark and I were working valet and Anna Kendrick pulls up in her car, she's like 5 foot nothing, and Mark and I are combined nearly 13 feet tall.
So you're saying she would probably
be afraid she was going to get eaten and stay in the car.
You know how long it would take to push a seat back? Like, I'd be like, Anna Kendrick! And then I have to drop the seat.
So you're saying she would probably just keep driving. Back.
Yeah, she would keep driving.
She probably drives the little smart car, a Prius, Mark. We could just pick it up, one guy on each side, and move it.
I bet you she drives like the biggest SUV available on the market.
Rolls up in a Tahoe?
Yeah. All right.
Quad cab, extended bed, supercharged.
So, yeah, to answer that question, Anna Kendrick driving like a huge Tahoe.
Yep.
Okay, well, actually, before we move on from the question, I just want to make a quick digression. I just want to say how sad I am that we are currently, because we mentioned him, how sad I am that we are currently in the final season of Key and Peele. Key and Peele, one of the best sketch shows, or probably the only good sketch show on TV currently. So, just saying, if you haven't watched Key and Peele, now would be a good time to start.
And then
I've been hearing the whole season.
They're amazing in Fargo. And you know what I found out? There's a Mad TV sketch with Bonquiqui where she's a... Have you seen that sketch where she's working at a drive-through or like a fast food restaurant? Yeah. And there's this woman behind the counter, and like if it's a complicated order, she's like, "Security, we got a complicated order." Well, like Key pops up, so he's been around since the '90s, like perfecting his craft.
Oh yeah.
So these guys aren't just like a sudden hit. They've been around for 20 years. So it's like you got to respect them. They did their time. Now they're big. Like these guys did it.
Yeah.
You know.
Listen, if you guys
perfectly,
want, like,
so I have a lot of respect for these guys.
If you never seen a Key and Peele skit, I would suggest watching Substitute Teacher, the Gremlins 2 skit. And they also did like a recent Neil deGrasse Tyson like parody.
Oh, my girlfriend showed that to me and her mother, saying, "This is what it's like living with John."
Oh man, I don't know if that's a compliment or an insult. Okay. All right. So anyway, yeah, watch Key and Peele, guys.
About it.
All right. Enough about Key and Peele. Lemongood, what's the topic that we're talking about this week?
So today we're talking about two movies that are really far from mainstream, but I imagine they're going to get really popular over time. It's two movies that Mark has written about actually quite a lot in the last few weeks. If you follow our website, Movies, Films, and Flicks, he's been talking about the best horror of the 21st century. He's been talking about horror hybrids. He's been talking about the new wave of horror. And these movies very much fall in line with that. They're very non-traditional. And the first of those movies is Creep. And I'll say about Creep, what I'm going to say later about our other movie, is that I probably would not have watched this if Mark hadn't watched it and really raved about it.
Really? You, the horror leviathan, would not have watched this.
That's I watch a lot of horror movies, right? But this would have been really deprioritized for me. The poster I didn't think was very interesting. I should add that the first 5 minutes of it had the most uncomfortable shaky camera work I've ever seen. But Mark wrote about that and said that in general the movie wasn't like that. So I waited. But the first 5 minutes of the movie, normally if I see something that shaky, I'll leave it. And I like found footage horror movies. They don't bother me. This is the only one actually irritated my eyes and started bothering me. And so, but I stuck through, and after 5 minutes, I swear to God, it was gone. 5 minutes, just after the guy gets up the steps to this, the creep's house, if you will, like, it was gone. But that's a good warning to the viewer. If you don't like shaky camera work, the first few minutes might scare you away, but afterwards that's going to go away.
Yeah, and what I like about Creep is the director, Patrick Bryce, and Mark Duplass, who I love Mark Duplass because the guy just creates. Like, he gets an idea and he makes a movie. He makes a TV show. And the two of them just got talking, and they started filming this. And, you know, like, initially, there was, like, no stress to it. They just started filming and creating. And, you know, it evolved over time, and it went from, like, a friendship to, like, a horror-type film to what it became at the end. And I just kind of love that it was, like, an organic film that just sort of happened because two people wanted to create something. And for me, that's what I love about horror, is these people who just create. I know that sounds weird, but it's not like – it's not reactive. They're not watching Paranormal Activity or Lost and going, we need to recreate that. There's just two people – who told a story that evolved, and they took their time out. Like, I don't know. I just appreciate that it was two people and a camera, and it came out to a tiny little product that is being seen nationwide.
Now, I want to get back to that, but before we get too into it, just for the listeners who haven't seen this movie, we are going to spoil some things, but this movie is about a videographer who responds to a Craigslist ad for, you know, a little cash. I think it's like $1,000 or something, to film a man for one day. And that man is Mark Duplass, who you'd know from the Mindy Project, The League, or The Lazarus Project. And Mark Duplass, he is dying from a brain tumor. He wants to make this kind of video diary for his unborn child because he's going to die very soon. And it, let's just say it gets very awkward very quickly.
Oh, yeah. The bathtub scene is hard to watch.
Okay, that was the first thing that I wrote about for this movie about when it started to get weird was that bathtub scene felt completely inhuman and disconnected, like an alien trying and failing to mimic human emotion.
Really? I don't know. I thought it was okay.
Did you?
I don't know. Maybe I'm just weird, but I just thought, like, oh, this is kind of a sweet moment. Right?
Says the single guy who probably winces when someone tries to hand him his baby.
I'm just saying. The dude was bearing his soul, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, that's right. And, like, what I liked is, this is going to sound weird, but when I was first getting going in production, I actually answered a Craigslist ad to work on an independent film. And it was called Undocumented Executive, and it turned out to be perfectly normal, and it was good for my career. But I made $50 a day from a Craigslist ad because I needed work and I needed money. So the fact that, I don't know, I sort of recognized what this guy was going through, that he was getting paid $1,000 to work for one day to film a guy, and the stuff that he would go through because he's kind of lonely. I wasn't lonely, but when you need money and you're in this thing and, like, you're just going to stick with it because you need the money. And so it kind of made a lot more sense to me why he would stay around throughout the day.
Right. Right. So you guys mentioned the hot tub scene as being really uncomfortable. I feel like the scene where you ask the camera to be turned off, but the dude kept the audio going, and Mark Duplass's character was going through the rape story. I felt like that was halfway through the movie, right? Yeah, about halfway through the movie, and I felt like that was the most uncomfortable moment in the movie because, like, you don't see anything, you only hear it, and, like, the story that Mark's character is telling, it's really unsettling. It's, like, really weird. And, like, this was kind of a turning point in the movie where, like, you see his character, like, as who he is. Like, he's just, like, he's not normal, really. Because before
He's oversharing something that's strange that shouldn't be socially acceptable.
Yeah. So
when we were talking before the pod, Lazvath, you said that you weren't really a fan of the film. Like, what kind of turned you off?
It's just that I'm kind of become jaded on found footage movies, really. I feel like, I don't know, like, it just, they don't really scare me, or, like, they don't really affect me, like the day, like, when I first saw Paranormal Activity years ago. Like, I feel like, you know, I'm kind of, like, I'm just bracing myself for, like, what's going to happen. But I do understand why people love this movie, and I think the reason why is because Mark Duplass. Like, there's something very likable about this guy, even though he kind of does, like, the creepy vibe very well. Like, you still, like, want to root for him. You know, you remember he did Safety Not Guaranteed.
Oh, I love that movie.
He did, like, he also played, like, a very eccentric character. And, like, but he was also really likable, and you wanted to root for him. And I also mentioned that, like, his character in Safety Not Guaranteed also posted, like a wanted ad.
So, oh, yeah.
So I thought that was kind of funny. But, yeah, Mark Duplass is, like, I think he's what drives this movie. Like, he's the reason, like, this movie, like, it's different, really. You know, I will say it's different from most found footage movies because it does, like, goes in twists and turns and ends up becoming something you didn't expect. But I don't know, I just become so jaded on these movies. I can't help but be, like, kind of meh, you know?
Lazabeth, I'll meet you halfway there because if he wasn't in this, I probably wouldn't have had the patience to make it very far. But between Mark's review and knowing he was in it, that's what kind of, again, got me through the first 5 to 10 minutes. But if he wasn't there for that kind of stakeholder, I wouldn't have stayed. I'm glad I stayed. I'm not going to go call this a great film. I'm going to call it, like, I'm going to say it's good. I'm over the hill enough to call it good for me. And there were some things about it, which I'll hold off to until we get there in conversation. But there are things about the filmmaking that made me, in hindsight, like it even more. From just good, we'll say.
I guess for me is, it doesn't, like, reinvent the found footage wheel, but it doesn't go flat. So I didn't leave it, like, you know, pumping my fists in the air after watching something really inspiring. But it also, for a weird reason, motivated me. And that's why I wrote about our current state of horror. And then that led me to write about the best horror of the 21st century. So for some reason, this movie, like, motivated me. It was just so little and I don't know, but it's a very motivating film, I guess.
Yeah, I think that you commented that, like, if you were an aspiring filmmaker, that you should watch this to get some inklings about filmmaking. It was something that to that effect. Yeah. And I very much feel that. Like, I have no interest in filmmaking, but when you commented something to that effect, it made immediate sense to me.
Yeah, and you know what I love about this movie is they went in trying to do one thing. That didn't work, so they tried another. Like, this wasn't an easy process, so two guys and a camera, they just stuck with it, and it evolved. Filmmaking's not easy, and so I love that, like, they kept with it, and they created it. And, like, there was no pressure on them until it started testing well, and then they're like, oh, crap, that we might have something. So, I don't know. I just, like, you know, of course Mark Duplass's name is on it, but two guys and a camera, and we're talking about this film. Like, that's rare, you know?
Sure, and that's even despite the wolf mask.
Yeah. Oh gosh, they made that for this film.
There's this wolf mask in this film, and it vaguely resembles the wolf head from An American Werewolf in London. I don't know, because it's got a little bluish gray tinge to it, but it's this awkward mask that kind of. At first, I thought it was forced in the movie. The first second I saw it, and then I thought, okay, all right, they explained it well. He had some almost psychopathic explanation for it. We were already questioning our trust for Duplass, of course, because the movie's called Creep. But he puts on the mask and he has this story, and it was so appropriately dehumanizing for me. Like, it's one thing when a character is crazy and they don't realize how crazy they are, or you think you can help them. But when he put on this weird wolf mask in front of his probably awkwardly terrified videographer and was explaining the family history of this creepy mask, like, I'm just thinking, this totally dehumanized Mark Duplass's character for me. If he dies, I will not feel that badly right now. Like,
and you know what makes him scarier? Is this guy preys on lonely people. You know, he preys on the people that will answer these ads and stick with him throughout the days. Like, he is a predator. Like, the people he kills are the people that are desperate enough or for money or weak enough that he can prey on them and latch on to them. Yeah. You know, like, that makes him even scarier, I guess. Because, I mean, there's really no trace of a Craigslist ad. You just answer it and you go there.
So if we fast forward to the end, because, you know, we got spoilers in here, so I can do that. So if you fast forward to the end, when you realize, like, the big reveal that, you know, he's done this to other people because he has this, he has the videotape and he, like, writes a title on it and he puts it in his collection. It's not just that he's been killing a lot of people on video ads. He's been killing a lot of people with the same ad.
Yeah.
Because they're all there must have been like 100 videotapes in his closet and these CDs that he made and all this stuff that are all labeled. And I'm just thinking, like, so all that stuff that we saw him awkwardly go through, like the bathtub scene, like I had to question, was this identical every time? Were there different iterations? Either way, he's probably lived through that bathtub scene before. So the awkwardness that we see is an even bigger psychological disconnect from humanity, not just because he was acting it the first time and it didn't seem human to me, but because he's done it many times and that's still how he does it.
So you're saying he might have, like, practiced his awkwardness?
No, I'm saying that he's done it over and over again, and it hasn't gotten any more convincing necessarily. He's so disconnected that even when we're seeing it for anywhere from, who knows, the 100th time that he's done this to someone, it still felt so awkward, like he didn't understand human emotion properly.
You think this movie is a parable for online dating in general?
A cautionary tale.
I mean, I got lucky with my Craigslist ads, but there have been people who have been shot. Like, I've read about it before where, like, people were killed over Craigslist ads. There's a Craigslist killer. I don't know. I think it's a good idea. No one's tapped into Craigslist. I think it was well acted by Duplass. Like you said, the camera work wasn't too shaky. And, you know, I guess for me, I'm jaded because since I've worked in production, I know why that guy would stay. You know what I mean? Like, I've been in some really bad shoots and I've stayed. Like, I've been on music videos that were 20 hours and, like, you could leave. Like, there's nothing keeping you from leaving, but you stay. And so add a very manipulative person to that and a very lonely person who is the videographer, and that could happen.
Well, I'm going to add something to that. And I don't think – if I was to attribute a flaw to this movie, it's that the money wasn't made very clear, or maybe I just blinked and missed it. But I think they should have had a few seconds really clarifying the amount of money that it was, because I read a little bit about this movie online and I came up with a numbers like $500 to $1,000. But I don't really for sure know what he got paid. I just know that it was enough that it was a lot for a day's work.
Yeah, so, in the beginning, he said $1,000 a day.
Okay. But that it was a blip, and then I never heard of it again. Yeah. So it's like, but if I knew that better while I was watching, I would have much better understood his pressure and guilt about staying versus leaving. Because even though our creep, Mark Duplass, gives him the money up front in a very selfless way, like, look, let's just get this out of the way, you know, like to be friendly and everything. You know, it's like, well, there's going to be that internal moral guilt if you just left.
Yeah.
And money drives – it does drive us quite a bit, especially if it's our livelihood. That's $1,000. That's what most people make in a week, you know, or not most people. I'm just saying it's not a day's work for a lot of people.
And I don't know, man. You know, like I said, I don't think this movie really is a game changer, but it's a very effective two-person in a camera movie. And that, I don't know, I like that. I like, I don't know, there's something about that process that I love. And I think the end with the axe, like, the guy is so naive. You know, Ebert used to talk about Chekhov's gun, but this one's Chekhov's axe.
Yeah, you mean that rule where it's like you don't put a gun on the wall in Act 1 unless it's going to fire in Act 3.
Yeah, and this axe gets used in Act 3. Oh, brother.
when he came to the house, he saw that axe, and he was nervous, right, before he even met creep Mark Duplass. And then later, like maybe a third of the way into the film, Mark Duplass mentions the axe and asks him if he was nervous about it. And so at that point, in the beginning, I thought it was a red herring. And then when he mentioned it later, I thought, okay, it's for sure a red herring because it's being addressed here. And we're not going to see any more of the axe. But then it double backed, and he took the axe to the head in a beautiful scene.
And the guy was so, like, trusting, and, like, he didn't think that he was going to be murdered at that moment. Like, I don't know. I guess, you know, he took good souls who needed money and just killed them with the axe to the head.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, did you guys also get, like, a little bit of a comedy, like, a vibe? Like, I thought there were some funny parts in this movie, too. Did you guys think there were some funny scenes in this movie? Because I don't know about you. This could just be me. But, like, the whole build up to like the him killing, you know, the guy with the axe, like when he slowly puts on the mask and he like he has the axe, but he's like slowly inching up to him. Like I was kind of laughing. I mean, I felt bad. Like that dude's gonna die. But
yeah, just it was definitely it was like absurd because the guy should have been paying attention.
Yeah.
Like, and he wasn't. And then Mark Duplass was just creeping up. And at the end of it, he's like, I have no idea why you weren't looking around. Like, why did you do that? There's a sense of humor to it.
And then he's scared, like, when he sees himself just pop up on camera. Yeah.
And he scares him, like, three times in this movie.
Yeah.
So I think, you know what I think, Levin Good? I think the axe is a good testing point. Like, the normal person might see it and drive away, but this guy didn't. Like, he tests him throughout the day.
You know what I mean? Yeah, he was pushing limits.
Yeah. But I don't know. For me, I just like that it's a very cheap little horror hybrid, which I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of. It Follows. What podcast is that, Levin Good?
Oh, God. I think that's podcast 12. It's 11 or it's 12. Human Centipedes and It Follows is either episode 11 or 12.
I think this day and age, we're going to be getting a lot of hybrids. I think that's where we're at. We got The Final Girl coming up, and this is part of the new wave. So, I mean, as opposed to people saying, oh, it's not horror, I think we should start embracing the new wave of horror that we're getting. And I think this is an important puzzle piece to that. And, you know, it's 93% on Rotten Tomatoes, so critics that's absolutely huge. Adore it. Yeah, critics love it. It's hitting, you know, what I like is it's hitting above its weight. And so you got to appreciate the little films that take off.
So, you know, so at the beginning I said there are all these reasons that I probably would have never watched it if it basically wasn't for you. And then I said, like, okay, like, it's good. It's good. I'll give it that. But now in the hindsight effect, like, well, after the movie, once I started thinking about it, and this started a little bit during the movie watching process. So I'm watching it with my girlfriend who works in mental health. And she, you know, knows a lot more of the mental conditions than your general run-of-the-mill street smart guy does, like me. And she was watching the movie and, like kind of nodding and wincing her head and furrowing her brow like she's thinking about Mark Duplass' character. And then she got on her phone. And I thought she was bored. Like, this is, like, after the bathtub scene, I think, or maybe after the wolf mask scene. And she started just going on her phone. And I thought, oh, God. She's hating this movie. We're going to have to stop the movie and I'll watch it the rest alone later. No, she looks at me and she was on the phone longer than normal, zooming around. I thought she was on Facebook and she said, here it is. And she showed me and it was schizotypal, not schizophrenic, but schizotypal. She was looking up diagnoses based on symptoms while watching the movie. And it made me like the movie more that she was thinking about something that I wasn't thinking about. Now I'm thinking about it and I'm happy I'm thinking about it. And then throughout the movie, she keeps saying, yeah, schizotypal. But there aren't a lot of murderers who are schizotypal. So then she Googles some more while we're watching the movie, mind you. But she looks around and she says, nope. There are, in fact, some serial killers who are schizotypal. So, okay, that works. And it's like, so, and then we looked on. Then she went, not me, the movie guy. She went to the Wikipedia page and found out that they actually paid a lot of attention. Of all the things that they were doing, like it was guerrilla filmmaking, they paid a lot of attention to the psychological profile and the thoughts of the behaviors of this person where they're inappropriately oversharing, over affectionate sometimes and ununderstanding other times, and lying compulsively and all these things. And so that made me really appreciate the filmmaking of this movie. And that kind of, so it's like, wouldn't have watched it. And it was good. Well, if I was watching it alone, I'm going to call it more than just good is my overall experience now.
You're welcome. Yeah, I didn't know about what you were just talking about, and that makes me like it more. I watched it again today to refresh it. Like, so it's a very layered film.
Yeah, but like that one thing, they did a good job. I mean, they did a good job on other things, but that was something that I normally don't think about when I watch a movie.
Interesting.
Hey, Levin, good quick question. Has she ever listened to this podcast?
She has listened to a couple episodes. The first one she listened to, as it turns out, and she picked randomly, she told me, was our 50 Shades of Lame, when we made fun of 50 Shades of Grey.
So you think she's listened enough to make a complete diagnosis of all three of us?
Well,
actually, before you answer that,
I think now she has.
Yeah. Before you answer that, let's take a quick commercial break.
Hey, y'all, it's Mark. And for you, the listeners of Movies, Films, and Flicks, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, there's a book that I really recommend to you guys, and since we've been talking about horror films tonight, it's a book called Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. It's a wonderful book. It's about 9 hours long, but it walks you through how Alien, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, how the classics were made, Rosemary's Baby. And if you're a fan of horror, if you're a cinephile, and if you're just a fan of classic cinema, I totally recommend Shock Value. It's a wonderful book by Jason Zinnemann. Totally recommend it. So to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook.
When I say pod, you say
pie.
Wait a minute.
Whoa. What's
Robert,
going on,
take
Kyle?
Take your headphones off real quick.
Okay, sorry.
John, what the hell is this?
Oh, I don't know. Robert invited me over.
And yeah, I don't know. This is kind of awkward. Are we doing like a promo or something?
I don't know. I wish he'd put on his pants, though.
Yeah, he's like dancing around. He's talking about Shark Dropper.
I think he's looking for the baby oil.
Anyways, Robert, what are we doing? Huh? What are we doing?
What was that?
What are we doing?
I can put my headphones back on?
Yeah.
Oh, we're doing a promo for Shark Dropper.
Oh, okay.
That podcast we do that has improv, and we just talk about our daily lives and
stuff. Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
I still wish you'd find your pants.
Where can I find it?
Oh, wait. Are we supposed to wear sharkdropper.com?
Sure, short time.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. Whoa. That was nice. So, Lemon Good. What was the final verdict?
Did you catch that?
Yeah.
I don't know if that burp was recorded.
It was.
Was that the hello after our break? Was my burp?
Yeah. I was trying to segue away from that. I'm just like, I don't know how to transition right now. I'm just going to jump right into it.
So, Adventures in podcasting.
So anyway, what was your lady's diagnoses on all three of us?
Amazing.
Amazing? Really?
I think that it was like man-childitis.
Okay.
God. I'll have to ask her after she listens.
All right. Mark, I think you got another listener question for us, right?
Yep. And this comes from Will from Facebook. And he wrote, who throws the best cinematic punch? So, I mean, you kind of got to say Harrison Ford because he does this weird thing where, like, he cocks back, then he throws his fist out, then he jumps into people.
Yeah, but, he literally jumps into it. He puts all of his body literally into it.
Like, he doesn't really need to, but he does. And it's like a glorious, weird punch. But I'm going to go different, all right? I'm gonna bring up a couple that I love. I'm gonna say Paul Walker's Superman punch in the Fast series. For some reason, he like mastered kicking his foot off a wall and punching somebody in the face. So I don't know. I always love the Fast Five Superman punches that Paul Walker throws. Bill Murray in Groundhog Day knocks out a guy pretty good.
Right.
And I was gonna say the Rocky movies, but anybody, if you hit somebody in the head that much and they didn't get knocked out, there's no way that could be the best punch ever. So I'm gonna say Bill Murray, Groundhog Day, best cinematic puncher.
I agree with you, and the reasoning is because that's great language there. But anyway, my reasoning is because, say you play like a boxer, like Sylvester Stallone and Rocky, you're expected to throw a punch, right? So it's just like kind of ho-hum. But Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, he just randomly throws a punch out there and knocks the dude out. But that's great. That's great cinema. I don't know. You're just entranced by the punch. Like, Bill Murray, like, he just did it so effortlessly. Like, he was, like, the complete opposite of Harrison Ford. Like, he did not, like, jump into it. He didn't put anything into it. He just, like, kind of love-tapped Ned Ryerson. He just got knocked out. It was amazing.
He chin-checked him.
Yeah.
So we got two Bill Murrays. What do you got, Levin Good?
All right, so I took this to the next level. I am doing not just who throws the best cinematic punches, but what was the best cinematic punch ever in the history of the universe.
All right.
And that is Joe Pesci in My Cousin Vinny.
What?
So this movie, which is pushing 25 years old, Joe Pesci is having a really rough day. He's an Italian lawyer who graduated from, like, the Brooklyn Academy of Law. No one's taking him seriously. And he's in the middle of nowhere, Alabama, trying to save his nephew. Or his cousin, I'm sorry, his cousin, Ralph Macchio. And there's this time where Marissa Tomei loses a bunch of money playing pool to this guy who, like, just stiffed her. This guy named Bud or something. And it's and so Vinny is going to go get the money back. And so he makes a bet with the guy where if he could knock him out with one punch, kick his ass in a fight, the dude would give him the $1,000 that he owed Marissa Tomei. So Joe Pesci, you know, he meets him three times. Each time the guy doesn't have the money. When he finally has the money, Joe Pesci is just walking up. He's had it up to here. He's covered in mud from something that happened earlier in the movie. He's totally fed up. And he Superman punches. Like, he jumps and both of his hands go forward like he's about to take flight. and even though one hand punches the guy and they both fall down. Like, Joe Pesci literally knocked himself over with his own punching inertia. So, Joe Pesci, hands down, Joe Pesci, best cinematic punch ever.
Okay, well, here's a good question. Who would win in the fight, Harrison Ford or Joe Pesci? Because they're both kind of just throwing each other, like, into their punches.
If Joe Pesci lands the first hit, it's the last hit.
Okay.
But and what if he has a pen, like in Casino, he's stabbing somebody to death.
What if their fists connect at the same time? Like, who wins that battle?
The world would explode.
Right.
Well, no, but see, if that happened, Joe Pesci would win because his punch would knock Harrison Ford out for sure.
Yeah, but Harrison Ford might not. He's taken thousands of punches in his life, in cinematic life, and he's never been knocked out.
Right.
Joe Pesci should have died three times during Home Alone, but he kept standing.
Three times.
Listen,
in that second one, he got a brick hit his head from four stories up, and he just went razza frazza fricka fracka.
Like, he's got a pretty thick skull, man. Like, he's not even human.
I do think Mongo from Blazing Saddles has a pretty good punch too, because he knocked out a horse.
You know, if you can knock out a horse, they got a thick neck, so that's tough.
I still feel like Bill Murray has the advantage over all these guys for reasons previously stated. Like, he just lays back, he just, like, throws out a little punch. He's like a sniper with his fist.
So if we put Bill Murray, Joe Pesci, Paul Walker, and Mongo into a cage
in a battle
royale, who leaves?
Bill Murray, but he wouldn't even like participate in the fight. He would just leave after the bell rings.
So Pesci and Paul Walker would team up on Mongo, right?
Yeah.
And then they would just knock each other out in a three-way punch, then he'd be declared the winner?
Yeah, I could see that happening.
Like Paul Walker would armbar somebody, and Joe Pesci would just kick him in the ribs while they're armbar.
Yes, yeah, Mongo would have no idea how to defend an armbar, so Paul Walker would be hanging out for dear life while Joe Pesci's Thunder, you know, not Superman punching him, Thunderman punching him.
But here's the thing. The cage is full of traps from Home Alone. So you got, like, the paint. You got the paint.
So they're going to get shocked.
Yeah.
They're going to get shocked and turn into skeletons.
Yeah.
Catch staples to every major orifice.
Yeah. It's a.
I like it.
It's a pretty brutal pay-per-view. Vince McMahon couldn't come up.
Who here better. Wants to see Bill Murray get hit?
I don't, actually.
I never want to see Bill Murray get hit by anything.
Yeah, no. Nobody, even if you were fighting him, you wouldn't want to hit Bill Murray.
Yeah.
You would just want to jostle with him.
If he insulted,
you want to wrestle with him a little bit.
If he insulted your mother, you're like, oh, that Bill Murray. He's out of
hand. You just let him get, yeah, Bill Murray. All right, so Bill Murray by just triple knockout.
Bill Murray insults your mother. That's our final answer. I think
there's your answer.
I think that answered the question.
I like
sort of, pretty much.
Yeah. All right, Levengood. What's the second movie that we're talking about today?
So our second new wave horror hybrid that we're talking about today is Spring. And again, a movie that I probably wouldn't have watched, at least not for a year or so, unless Mark hadn't been raving about it. And in this case, I was thrilled with this movie. The reasons that I really wouldn't have watched it without Mark, though, is that this was written and directed by Justin Benson. And he did the short film Bone Storm in the latest VHS viral movie. And I thought that that was the hands-down worst short film of all the 15 short films in the three VHS movies. Hands down. I would avoid this guy like the plague. However, Mark wrote a great review, and the cover art on the posters for this movie, Spring, are so thought-provoking, interesting, beautiful, that at that point I had to watch it. And again, thrilled to have watched it. It's about a kid who loses his mother, a 20-some-year-old guy who loses his mother horribly to cancer. He tries to escape his grief with an impromptu trip to Italy. In the middle of it, he ends up getting involved as a day laborer from some very friendly old Italian guy who speaks broken English, and he meets a very enigmatic woman with an even more enigmatic past. Now, Mark, you really championed this movie. You got me excited to see a movie that I would have otherwise avoided like the plague. What do you have to say?
I mean, I just loved it that it played like Before Sunrise met Species. You know, like, it's like this new horror film with a new story. It's like Under the Tuscan Sun, but with a man and an alien. And I like that the director's created a new kind of monster. A creature. Like, very rarely in cinema do we get new creations. And this movie has a new creation. It has a likable guy. There's one part of it that I don't like, but we'll get to it. It's not that I don't like it, I just don't buy it. But I like that it's a new creation. It's sumptuously filmed. It's smart. It's I don't know. I liked it. It was well acted. It was romantic. And you don't get that much in movies these days. And I just like that I got something new.
I like that you use the word sumptuously.
You can't use that much. But like, yeah. There's a line in the movie. I love it where he's like the main character Lou Taylor Pucci. He's like Pucci, he's like, I'm living the fantasy of some rich American home life. And I just love that line. I don't know. I just like that it's some independent little film by two people. And I dig it. I dig it.
I love that you mentioned Before Sunrise, because I was about to say, like, this movie, if I were to describe it to someone, like, I would tell them, like, this is the movie that Richard Linklater would make if he were hired to do a horror movie. But as he was making the horror movie, he kind of fell back into old habits. He kind of got entranced by the Italian countryside, and he ended up making a completely different movie than what he was hired to do. So I think that's how I would describe this movie.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
And on the poster, you know why I knew Levin Good would like this? They describe it as a hybrid of Richard Linklater and H.P. Lovecraft. And if you've been listening to the podcast for some time, you know that John Levengood, the horror Leviathan, loves tentacles, and he loves squishy noises, and he loves romantic films. So this is romance with tentacles and squishy noises. What?
We'll let you put those things together.
And they did. And they did put those things together, and shockingly well.
Right.
John loves tentacles and squishy noises.
Yeah.
And Love Actually was one of my favorite. It was my favorite theatrical experience ever.
Because
and
of,
I guessed
because
it.
Of tentacles.
And I knew you would like.
I guessed it several podcasts ago. Yeah, but not like this movie. Like it was really sweet. And your review online, you actually compared it to An American Werewolf in Paris. And I didn't read your review. I often don't read reviews of movies right before I watch a movie because I don't want to have things in my head. I wait until right after I watch the movie actually to read the review, which is kind of backwards. But when I saw that you wrote that, that was what I was thinking the whole time. When you say, you know, the Before series with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, I'm like, okay, yeah, I get that. And you compare it to other movies, you know, I'm like, okay, I get that. But American Werewolf in Paris, I was thinking that the whole movie while I was watching it.
Yep,
His awkward kind of initially lovelorn experience of being kind of rejected or pushed away or kept at a distance. He's on this adventure, if you will, of self-discovery, regardless of the reasoning. There are a lot of romantic reaches. If you're watching this, the one criticism I'd have about the story is the one thing that you have to realize as a film watcher that you need to check at the door. And that was the acceptance of the romance, given the very short period of time that they had, and what we learn about our female love interest, is that she should know better, more than any human on the planet should know better about the situation. But at the same time, and we'll get to that in a little bit, but at the same time, like, that's the kind of thing you check at the door. These movies are more about longing than they are about love after the fact. So it worked very well for me.
I do think the directors were very naive about love in a little bit, and what you were talking about at the ending. I do think they made up for it, like, in certain ways. So even if we kind of disagree with that, and you got to check your suspension of belief at the door, but I did like their meet cute. Did you guys like how they met? Like, she comes up to him and she's like, let's go back to my room. And he's like, well, shouldn't we get coffee first? Or, like, shouldn't we, like, you know, get a beer? You know what I mean? Like, that never happens in movies. Like, think about that Species movie. She's like, come with me. And they're like, all right.
Well, he had that great reaction. He was like, what are you, a prostitute or something?
Yeah. Like- Yeah, so in the film, they kind of have this meet cute where Luis, I believe, meets him and at this beautiful cafe. And she's like, all right, come back to my room. He's like, well, are you a prostitute? She's like, no. He's like, well, can't we just get coffee? Like, that was fun. Like, I like that a lot. Like, you don't see that in films. And so, you know, maybe they thought that was enough for her to kind of fall in love with him. But I don't know. I thought that was a really good introduction between two characters.
And it was actually the opposite of American Werewolf in Paris in a cheeky way. Because in American Werewolf in Paris, he meets her and tries to convince her to go to coffee, and she says no. But when she finally agrees, he all of a sudden his friends pressure him, and he's got condoms in his pockets, and they fling out really embarrassingly, and he's wearing sunglasses, and he's trying to play it cool. And it was total opposite here. It was really nice. More human in this movie. We get the Species reference, which, as it turns out, without the actual predation, was very close. Analogously to what was going on in that scene, what she wanted, she just wanted to take him and leave that sailor at sea.
Oh, and yes, she did.
And like, I don't know. I guess I like Walking and Talking a lot. I'm a big fan of Walking and Talking. So any movie with like Top Five or the Before series where people walk and talk, you know, I'll buy it.
Or like any Aaron Sorkin TV show.
Yeah, exactly. Downton Abbey. Maybe that's why I love Downton Abbey so much, all the Steadicam walking and talking. But no, it was a small film. It was an ambitious film. I guess the main problem for me is, I'm going to go right into it, is that this immortal who has lived thousands of years would become mortal for this just nice guy. Like, he's not Ethan Hawke in the Before movies. He's kind of a blank slate. He's a good dude. But never once was I like, give up immortality for this guy. Like, you know, I was like, don't do it. Like, it's kind of bad at the end when you're saying, like, you don't know him.
Well, but didn't she mention, I maybe just be picking at just threads here, but, like, didn't she mention that, like, she can't really, like, control, like, what happens? Like, her body just kind of chooses it for her? Or maybe I just kind of misheard.
Well, so she doesn't choose her form, but she has a recollection of her past lives. That's how she speaks dozens of languages. It's how she's come so far with her own genetic research on herself. So she has these memories, and she knows that she's been in, you know, she's liked men before. So she could choose to go off, make her little Cthulhu monster tentacle change, and come back and stay with him, which baffles me that she didn't.
Yeah, so I guess that kind of fell apart for me at the end. But at the end of the day, it was a sumptuously filmed horror hybrid.
Yeah.
If she did that, though, she'd keep doing it every 2 years when she has to transform again. And at some point, it's like the vampire analogy where you have to turn them, otherwise you have to watch them die. But, like, they could have kept dating for a whole other transformative body of time or longer. Like, they didn't. It didn't have to be, you know, boom or bust right now.
Yeah, and she had a ton of money, so she could have taken, like, they could have kept dating after that, and then she could have been like, well, I'll give up immortality now. But I don't know. So for me, it felt like a little bit of the male dream, but that's me picking on it and sounding very pretentious. But
That's very fair, though, because, you know, it's like after the movie, if you think about it, she's probably been with so many men and had an occasional, you know, love interest that lasted even longer than this, where she had more time to think about it. And here we are, you know. So I get it. It's a fair criticism. We're lending ourselves to the fantasy, and I think that's okay.
Yeah.
We're allowed to criticize it after the fact and point our fingers at all these different things, as long as we say it's okay at the end.
So yeah. No, yeah. It would have been a better ending if she didn't give up immortality. Would you say?
Well, you know, the thing is that it would have made more sense to me, but it wouldn't have been as satisfying an ending, would it? Even though I can nitpick at it, like, it wouldn't have been as satisfying.
I know this is really bad, but let's say she doesn't give up immortality, then he gets, like, then he sees her, like, 6 weeks later somewhere, or she comes, finds him. You know, like, yeah. I don't know. But you know what, though? These are young filmmakers. These are guys who are, you know, Richard Linklater was supposed to make a horror film, and he got caught up in the romance. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the people in the Before trilogy stayed together, and look how that went for them. So,
okay, I think the question we should be asking is, how would Nicholas Sparks approach this movie?
Oh, God, she would have taken mortality, then he would have been shot by a bullet.
Yes, yes.
Then he'd have gone to war and died, and then she would have sat there, and then she would have gotten cancer.
Oh, it's such a Nicholas Sparks move.
You know, they may be young filmmakers, and we talk about accepting the fantasy in lieu of what would make more sense, very obviously, I think, in our opinions on the screen. But, like, I gotta say, I really did love watching their relationship transpire. And if you were to literally edit out everything, even remotely horror-related, such that it was just a romantic drama, I would watch that movie and enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong about Evan. I know I said he was a blank slate. Like, he's a good kid. Like, Evan is a good kid. Like, he helps his friend at the bar. He's had some problems. He kind of delayed his life. He's polite to people around him. He's not a total bro. He's just kind of along for the ride. I liked him as a character. I thought the actress was really good.
Nadia Hilker.
Yeah, she was real. I've never seen her before. And I think that helped a lot because I had no idea who she was, but she was very earthy. And I thought it was a very good performance. Like, she was sophisticated. She was cool. I thought it was like a really good lived in backstory, which, you know what, though? Even as much as I complain about her supposedly becoming immortal, like, these two characters did have lived-in backstories, which is more than you can say for 90% of romance or horror characters. So, like you said, you just got to brush a couple things off your shoulder, and it's a very good film.
Yeah. So, speaking of cool backstories, how cool was it that he gets to Italy, he randomly finds this old farmer who wants a day laborer, you know, to work on his farm in exchange for a room and food. That's it. Very simple deal. And then later, as the movie goes on, we find out that this old guy was one of the past love interests of Louise.
What?
You didn't catch that?
I didn't catch that.
So they go around and they see a painting at the museum, and she says that's her. Meanwhile, the old guy, he talks about, you know, his lost love and how he's done with love earlier in the film. And then the old guy goes into town, and he won't explain why he's going to town to Evan. And then later we see the trinket, the locket that the old man has, and Evan looks at it really hard. Like, it's very obvious that he's paying attention to it. He says, "Who's that?" And he says, "That was the woman." And the picture is almost identical to the picture in the museum of Louise from, like, way back when, like 50 years ago.
Right.
So she's just breaking hearts left and right.
Yeah.
So she was – and that's why also when he was walking through this big courtyard with her, he looked a little longer at the guy when he saw where he was, like, praying. In the archway, because that old man was one of her old love interests.
Yeah. Interesting.
You didn't catch that, Mark?
No.
Wow. I saw you on Skype. Your eyes just like they're just like wide open right now.
I was like, maybe I was just swept away by the Italian vistas.
I was too.
So Lazarus, once again, we were talking before the pod, and you kind of had mixed feelings about this. How so?
So. When you guys told me that we were going to discuss this movie. The only thing I knew about it was that, well, I, you know, obviously it's a horror movie because, you know, we're watching it for this podcast. I didn't know anything about it going in. Like, I went in totally blind. I was expecting, like, a just another horror movie. I didn't expect it to be, like, a romance in the style of, like, a Richard Linklater film. So, it was, this movie is a really slow burn, you know. It's just, it's not really fast-paced like a normal horror movie. Like, it's just, like, I don't know, like, I appreciate, like, the story. I even, like, you know, in hindsight, like, they needed, like, the slow pace to develop the relationship between those two. But at the same time, it's, like, the whole time, like, as someone going in expecting a horror movie, I was expecting, like, to be scared. That never really came. But I did enjoy seeing the relationship between these two develop. So, it, yeah, so it's just, it's mixed feelings, pretty much.
But if I would have said, like, I got some horror hybrids for you, would you have, you know what I mean? Would that have been better for you?
Maybe. I would have, it would have been, I would have been more prepared for it. But no, I don't think this is a bad movie. It's just like, I don't know if I want to call it a horror movie.
Yeah, see, that's a conundrum I'm coming across nowadays. Like, when I came up with that 21st century horror list, is people are like, it's not horror. But on every single thing, or like people writing about horror, it's categorized as horror. So for me, I'm like, you don't almost want to add it, but then everyone else is calling it horror. So I think it's like a perfect example of the hybrids that we're living with nowadays.
Yeah. It's just, yeah. I don't know. It's, I enjoyed watching the movie. I don't know. Like, it's just, I just don't feel too strongly about it one way or the other.
So when you were watching it, right, and in Amar, Lazaveth, I also went into this pretty blind. I just knew from Mark's review title and from the movie posters that tentacles were somehow involved, mm-hmm. and that it was somehow a romantic story and that it was a horror. That's all I knew. That was it. I read nothing online deliberately. And so when she started getting her hints during the movie, her hints of some kind of transformation that she kept suppressing with this inoculation that she herself had had cultivated, like, you know, she, like, at one point she's going down an alley,
yeah,
and it almost looked like she was turning into a werewolf or something. And then later you see her down a wide angle down a hallway as a silhouette, and she's kind of moving in this skulky, like, elongated body form, almost like she was about to turn into a werewolf and drop on all fours or something. And I was thinking, like, is this a werewolf movie? I thought there were tentacles. And then later, she starts turning, you know, weird bubbling on her leg. And then when Evan finds her on the floor convulsing in her apartment, she looks like a tentacle centaur.
Yeah.
Like,
I will say, like, those moments, they were definitely creepy. But the thing is, like, it wasn't the focus of the movie. The focus was on their relationship. And sometimes when you watch a movie, you can tell, you know, where a movie is going. And when I was watching this movie, I'm just like, I don't think they're necessarily trying to scare me. They're just trying to, you know, try to add, like, a new dimension to their relationship somehow. So I was,
they're just easing us into Louise's weird situation.
Yeah. It felt like the movie wasn't preparing me for, like, a bloodbath at the end. It was preparing me for, like, I don't know, like a weird, like a dimension added to their relationship, really. So.
No, I get you. And I do, you know, I like the name of the title. I wrote Spring, Love in a Time of Squishy Things. You know, it's better than cholera. But you know, the one thing that did annoy me was the American that she kills. Or, like, didn't American tourist walk up to her and go, hey, you girl, you're standing in an alley by yourself. I'm going to do inappropriate things to you. And it's like, oh, come on, guys. Come on.
He's like the stereotypical American frat bro. He's wearing, like, board shorts. He's wearing, like, a U.S. flag as a bandana.
Yeah, and it's like, guys, you write this, you know, romantic film full of nice gestures and kindness and squishy things, and then you add the most prototypical American frat boy. Like, that didn't – like, I think it would have been better had it not been a terrible – American frat boy.
That was the American Werewolf in Paris influence again.
Yeah. It's like, it would have been better if she just killed somebody. I don't know. Like, I don't know.
Or even if it was just some drunk guy staggering down the street and you're not really sure, like, anything about him. Is it a good guy or not? And she just preys upon him in her desperation.
Yeah, like, give me that. Like, that's what a werewolf would do. Like, don't just make it some, like, hey, you broad, I'm American with a bandana. Kill me.
It's like, hey, are you okay? Are you okay? Hey, come here. Do you want to go to my place? Do you want some drugs?
And then she, like, turns him...
drugs?
Yeah, and then, like, she, like, turns him down, and then, of course, he goes, bitch. You know, like... It's like, no, she's not. Just don't be that guy.
Meanwhile, she's staggering around like she needs some serious help.
that scene did definitely annoy me. But I guess you're right. It's hard. I guess it's a horror hybrid because you can't really – I guess you could call it a romance, but then it's like science fiction.
I'm going to say
I have no problem, not even for a second, just flat out calling this a horror.
Okay.
I think it's like –
because if at any time someone thinks that they're watching – a romance movie and wants to stop watching because of an aversion to slimy tentacles, we've taken it out of romance.
Yeah.
I think it's like it's a horror movie in spirit, but it ends up being a romantic movie.
Like, I'm happy to give it the hybrid label, but it's like horror is one of those things where if you're hybridized with horror, you're horror. You're simply horror. It's not like, is it a drama or is it a funny drama or is it a comedy? It's not like that where it's not consequential. Like, you know, you got to, it's got to go in the horror section, even if we call it a romantic drama horror.
Yeah. Right. I love what Lazvath, you summed it up perfectly when you said Richard Linklater was sent to make a horror movie. He fell in love with the Italian countryside and he made this.
Yeah.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
That
should have been my entire review. I could have saved so much time.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
You go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. I do want to agree with a previous point you made. The idea for the monster in this movie, like, that's a great original idea. Now, for those of you who don't know, she is basically like an immortal. She's not like, not just like a werewolf or like an octopus. She basically, was it every 2 years, right? She basically needs new genetic information to kind of replenish herself and genetic,
which is why she has to mate.
Yeah. AKA sex, AKA bareback riding. So, she uses like the stem cells from the developing embryo inside her to kind of just become, you know, a young 20-year-old again. So that's kind of cool. But like in the days before, like she turns, like she goes to like all sorts of like the evolutionary, like just traits from our genetic past or whatever. So she turns like all sorts of different like creatures or hybrids. And it's very cool to see. I want to see this creature again in an actual horror movie or like, you know, a straight up horror movie. Like that would be cool to see.
That's what Harbinger Down is about.
Is it? Oh, that's the...
I guess it's about a tentacle monster.
Yeah, I guess they find one of her kind angry and frozen.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't know. I like it. These guys are second time directors. Aaron Moorhead and I think Justin directors.
Yeah.
So
like you said, it's a sumptuously shot movie.
Yeah, sumptuously shot.
And we talk about some scenes that seem like maybe like rookie mistakes, like that alley scene. Well, really just that I'm going to point to. But then like all these other scenes that we maybe didn't talk about, just his growing relationship with the older farmer. That was beautiful. Seeing that relationship was beautiful. And the opening scene where he loses his mother, I can't help but to believe that one of these two filmmakers had to have experienced that because I've been in a room and held a hand of someone and literally heard them take their last breath. And I was there when I was watching that scene. That scene was a little too good and a little too real to have just been machinated in front of a keyboard on their computer. So, I mean, that was beautiful and it felt selflessly sincere. So there's a lot of beautiful scenery. So don't take, like, anyone who's listening who hasn't seen it, don't think this is like a kind of cool romantic horror. And then, oh, yeah, there's this stupid scene in the alley and we're going to dismiss it. Like, this is a beautiful movie.
Yeah. And I don't know. And also, if this was a Nicholas Sparks film, I'm looking at a picture of this. She is grabbing his jacket. Now, the best Nicholas Sparks film is where Rachel McAdams has her hand on Ryan Gosling's face. So this would, if this was a Nicholas Sparks film, this would be right up there with The Notebook.
Right.
Ooh, there's a statement. You know what? I think I buy that.
John, write it down, throw it on the ground, and put it in the file cabinet later.
All right.
Nicholas Sparks, we are watching your movies in the future to see if you rip us off, and we will sue you.
Spring didn't have any rain kisses, though, so it's got that going against it.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to see squishy tentacle rain kisses.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know Levin good.
She produced so much slime in that last transformation scene that we saw on camera when he finds her in her apartment that she basically was producing her own slimy rain kisses.
I like it. I want to see this character again, though. I like this character, and it's a shame that we can't see it again. But maybe that's a good film, you know?
Yeah.
Fan fiction.
So when she gives up immortality, she also gives up turning into, like, weird monsters, right? Like, she's just normal. Yeah.
But she's got a bankroll, so I guess we'll have a nice leisurely life.
Yeah, maybe she's just retiring from immortality. Like, she was just working. Like, have, like, a nice... she basically went to a quote-unquote early retirement. Retiring at age.
Imagine 20. when they get into a fight. Sorry, Lazabeth, for interrupting. Yeah. Imagine them getting into a fight like a year from now. Like, I gave up immortality for you. You're sitting on the couch.
I'm sorry. Are you gonna lord that over me for the rest of my life?
He's like, I didn't ask you to give up immortality. Yes, you did. Oh yeah.
You know, I think I want to see that movie too. Can we call it like After Spring? It could be like a trilogy.
Oh, yeah, After Spring.
I do not want to see, like, summer is going to be fun after spring, but then fall could be bad because, like, this kid replaced all his emotions from his grievance into a woman. And then, like, after this transformation, he starts to come to his senses and he realizes what happens.
Yeah.
Maybe he wants to move back to America and she doesn't want to. And, you know, all this resentment. No. It's like romantic movies historically are more about longing than actual love. They generally end with the couple getting together, like Sleepless in Seattle, or every little segment in Love Actually. Think of all the greatest romance movies you've ever seen, and they end where the couple is just getting together.
Yeah, but that's not real life, though. I'm just saying.
People that's just it. I don't want to see the dose of real life afterwards. It might not be so pretty.
I want an Annie Hall type film like this.
I think it would be great if these guys, the filmmakers, made like a kind of before type trilogy with these characters. We could call it like spring, summer, and then fall.
You know what would be funny is if the third one, when they're kind of at odds and they're fighting a lot, is actually Guillermo del Toro's adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's In the Mouth of Madness. The Mountains of Madness, the Cthulhu movie, The Mountains of Madness. Because she just goes Cthulhu monster crazy and starts just killing the world.
Wait, I thought you gave this up. Fooled you.
Fooled you.
Squid is dumb.
All right, guys. I think that does it for a podcast, right?
Yeah.
We've gone through Joe Pesci, Harrison Ford fights, some tentacle love, some sumptuously shot scenes. I think that's a good podcast.
Yeah, I think we nailed everything on our docket.
Yeah, that was a weird checklist to go through, but we did it. All right,
and
guys.
You didn't think we could do it, Levin Good.
Yeah. Like, oh, they'll never hit tentacle love. Oh, they did. All right, guys, before we sign off, do we have any plugs to make?
Squishy Things.
Yeah, squishythings.com. Check them out.
Rate and review our podcast.
Yeah. Check out moviesfilmsandflicks.com. Check out sharkdropper.com. Also, quick reminder, I'm going to be at PodFest, which is next weekend in L.A., so if you're going to be out there, come say hi. And, yeah, I think that's it, right, guys?
Buy him John Lazabeth will be autographing breasts for free.
I always do that.
During PodFest?
Yeah, that should go without saying.
how many breasts did you autograph just while we were recording today?
Like, do you want me to count single ones, or do you want me to go by pairs?
How many pairs?
Like, I stopped counting at 20.
Like 20? Yeah, I mean, I figure every now and then, like, I can't hear you well, and I think it's because you're moving away from the microphone because you're busy signing boobs.
Yeah, it's too bad they're not all female boobs. Some of them are guy boobs.
In fact, mostly hairy man boobs.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Hey, those are our listeners, so thank you guys.
Yeah.
John will gladly continue to sign.
Our listeners have the best boobs out of any podcast. I'm going to put that out there.
Hands down.
Yeah. All right, guys. For my host, Mark. For my co-host, Mark Otmar.
Kurt Russell.
And John Levengood.
A loving and squishy goodbye.
I've been your host, John Lasso. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you guys next time.
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! 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 This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.